one's about colors and metallicities, and I'll start and I'll talk for a while, and then Gene and Jay all take over. And so we, our plan is that this will not go on till 5 o'clock. So I guess you, you can ask lots of questions. But we
then after 3, after cookies. Yes.
But so we don't have that many slides between us, I don't think. So as I had joked last time, it wasn't a complete joke, right? So we were getting these conflicting emails for the white paper, the decadal survey. With dynamical evolution, was that's where all the action was. Colors, metallicities, formation history, that's where all the action was. So we did the dynamical evolution before, and we'll do the colors and metallicities and formation history now. So some of the things I'll do, and the other reason for this is that there is some controversy about a few of these things that bubbled up during the conference, and at least one of the organizers, not me, wanted to hear more about it. And so, Gene, in this subject, on this subject, Gene and Jay and I have differences, so you'll hear about those. But there are other things here. Neither of us wanted just to focus on that. So there are other things here for which that's not the case. So I'll try to give it a little more broadly than that. Because one of the other statements was we don't just want to hear a bunch of discussions of observational details, but in fact that's where most of those differences lie. So we wanted to bring up other stuff. Okay, these are just people who've worked with me. As I said, I'm not so old that I can't use the wiki page, but I am old enough that most of my real work is not done by me. So here's sort of an overview that, since we did the morning, doesn't matter too much. So I'll really just focus on the colors and metallicities of the extragalactic, and the galactic globular clusters, and what those mean for cluster and galaxy formation evolution. So we did the evolution, but I didn't actually talk much about the structural parameters. Several of us, I gave my own views on how the clusters actually form, and other people here have done similar discussions in the morning on that. And then I'm actually spending a reasonable amount of my time working on black holes, especially through X-ray observations, which will come up here later. Okay, so the first part, I think it's important to start here, is that the main theme of basically the first end slides is that there's no, for a typical galactic globular cluster, is not self-enriched. And so there's two ways you see this. The most obvious one is the remarkable uniformity of the iron peak abundances within stars in a globular cluster. And so that strongly limits self-enrichment. And this is, in some sense, an old story. And it's a story that remains viable, even though part of it, we've heard a lot over this whole program about the about multiple stellar populations and all this. This is all going on not with the iron peak elements, okay? And it's important to remember that. The constancy of the iron peak is not debated. Only the brightest, most, only not just, but it's, oh, there's only like two, maybe three, right, galactic globular clusters that have a variation among the stars within an individual cluster in the iron peak abundances. So this requires rapid formation of globular clusters and no retention of the supernova ejecta. In fact, it's why all of the multiple stellar population models for the lighter elements appear to me, as a sort of non-involved person in the field, be really contrived, because you don't have the iron peak abundances varying, but then suddenly you get all these other ones, so you need to get rid of your supernovae and not use that gas, because that will have all sorts of new iron in it and give you a distribution, and then somehow form the stars separately from that. I guess in the massive star case, you do it before that happened. In the AGB case, you do it after you somehow lose all this stuff and get new material in. So it's it makes that contrived. But it doesn't, and that's a whole problem in itself and a very interesting one, but it doesn't change anything about this issue. And then the second part, because in the extragalactic case, of course, we don't get to trace the individual abundances, but The absence of self-enrichment can also be seen in the absence of a mass-metallicity relation for the galactic clusters. So I'll talk about this as a system, because this is more similar to what we do when we study globular clusters in other galaxies. So it's a system of globular clusters. Here's the magnitude and the metallicity from the Harris catalog. So galactic globular clusters have a bimodal metallicity distribution. This has been known for a long time. The metal poor ones and the metal rich ones. And there aren't that many, so splitting them up is not completely trivial. There are spatial and kinematic differences, and so nobody questions in the Milky Way. There are the thick disk bulge metal rich clusters over here, and the more halo metal poor clusters over there. And of course, people try to then subdivide those young and old halo and all this other stuff. If you just take the luminosity and the metallicity, you get this. And it's also true then if you try to say one of the things about self-enrichment is, in general, it's certainly true for galaxies where we know self-enrichment, well, we don't know, but we certainly believe self-enrichment happens, that the more massive galaxies, the more massive systems retain the supernova ejected more easily. So all self-enrichment models generally expect that the more massive objects are higher in metallicity because they retain their metallicities better. The metals that are made, they retain those longer, can have more generations of stars made from that new material. It's certainly what we observe when you do a galaxy mass metallicity relation. Do you see one? You see a clear one. Okay, but there's no relation here. That's not debated, but I still was going to go through and do it. So first, you have to split into the metal-rich and metal-poor subpopulations, well, because that's what we're going to do in the extragalactic case, and they might do completely different things, so it makes sense to do that. So if you do a former mixture modeling fit, you actually divide the population here, which is about where you should. And then you say, okay, in this population, is there a mass metallicity trend? Of course, it doesn't look like one to your eye. And if you do the formal fit, there isn't one. And the formal exponent on a slope, if you do Z metallicity versus LV, is 0.008. So it's practically identically zero. Of course, there's not one over here either. So you get a consistent story then. It's good. There's no mass metallicity relation. There's no FE abundant spread within individual clusters. So with few exceptions of omega sen, basically, the galactic globular clusters are not self-enriched. And that's all great, and then we'd be done with this part of the talk. Except I'll say it means a few things. To me, it really emphasizes that globular clusters are not small galaxies. Galaxies have a clear mass metallicity relation. And that's thought to be tied to their dark matter halos and their formation. So there's two things it tells me. So although we'll talk more about this later on, the clusters which there's individual evidence for an absence of a dark matter halo, it's a very small number, the absence of a mass metallicity relation compared to galaxies that do have dark matter halos which have one would tend to push you in this direction. And also, when we see globular cluster-like things form locally, when you do the young star clusters, young massive dense star clusters, they form as part of a star formation process. They don't have dark matter. There's no reason they would have dark matter halos. If you look in the antennae, and you find the massive star clusters in the antennae, a fraction of which you're going to survive for a Hubble time, they're forming as dense molecular cloud, compressed molecular clouds. We actually think we even sort of might understand that through the high pressure in these systems. And anyway, it clearly has nothing to do with dark matter. So if that is what happens generally, in terms more broadly for cluster formation over all cosmic epochs, then this all makes sense. The fact they're not self-enriched isn't surprising. The dynamical time scales, the really massive compact clusters, are actually in many cases shorter than the time scale to make a type 2 supernova. So this all sort of fits together. Okay, so the reason this talk isn't going to stop here, and that where the controversy is several studies using HST data find what's called a blue tilt, and I'll show what I mean by that, in extragalactic globular cluster systems. Actually, I realized I'm not sure I'll show you what I mean by that. So it means that the idea is that if you look in an extragalactic globular cluster system, I figured Jay could show his own plot, so I didn't actually put it, is that the idea is that there's a tilt in the metal poor cluster system in some of the extragalactic cases, so that the more massive luminous ones up here are redder and metal rich than the less massive, less luminous ones over here. So this thing tilts.
Is that from the diagram, the luminosity function at minus one metallicity, is that significantly different from either side?
No, not statistically. So you can line them up, the metal. You can play games with how exactly we would divide it up. But no, it's not statistically significantly different. It should be the metal poor ones should be a little brighter. And so this is why when I mentioned the thing in the morning about M87, it's different. It's if you just plot these up, partly because there's so few over here, and you should really give yourself the freedom to let this slide a little bit.
Well, what I meant was actually in this middle bin.
Oh.
It seems to be something we're seeing in some extragalactic systems that there's this intermediate.
Oh. So, but in here, you're just such a small number.
Are you talking about the cosmic H term?
Cosmic H. Yeah. So, okay. Okay. That's right. It's certainly in the Milky Way system. You wouldn't say anything based on that. Okay. So, this raises the question. I just spent time in the beginning saying Milky Way globular clusters are not self-enriched except for just such a few number of exceptions that it's clearly those are the exceptions to the rule. But our extragalactic globular cluster is different. What's going on? So, these are all this work for which Jay and Jean wrote one of the first papers. You use single orbit HST data for the Virgo galaxies that was followed up later by the ACS-VCS team. And then Bill Harris at about the same time had longer exposures for more distant galaxies. So in fact, since I'm not involved at all, you can say people start arguing about priority, where I'll argue whether it's real. But there is a controversy even about who found it first.
I did not take part in this controversy.
Is it?
Okay.
We can talk about this when we're at dinner and not being filmed. Our idea was we're going to test it. We have this really deep ACS data set that I described in the morning, and we're going to test that with that. So here's the answer. And the answer is we don't find a trend in the really deep data set. So here it is, magnitude, bright ones, faint ones, color, blue ones, red ones. We do really complicated bootstrap resampling to get the right error bars on our mixture modeling fits on each side. Because if you just take one and take uncertainty in the mean of your one, you're not really getting the right uncertainties. And then you separate these out, you fit the blue one and the red one, and you do it in magnitude, you go down, and you can do a running average, you can do it in bins, and we do it all these different ways, it's all in a published paper, and we don't find a significant mass metallicity relation. And the best fit here has an exponent of 0.08 on the metallicity, and the Harris et al. Number is 0.55, so it's way far away. Okay. Yeah, it's very impossible to see. Here is, it'll show, maybe it won't show up better in the next one. Okay, well here, I'll show it in this one, and I'll go back if you want to see it. The question is, could we see it if it was there? So here is an artificial data set where we put in the trend. This is what the slope looks like. There was a really bad green line there. It actually looks okay on the computer screen, but not up here. Here is what the slope would be if you put this in, and when we use with an artificial data set with the uncertainties drawn from the real data, and here is what happens if you put in a zero slope, and here's what you see. And of course, it looks a lot more like this than this.
Trend.
Here, let me trace out the green line. I can see it up here. I realize it's absolutely impossible to see from there, but it goes up there.
What is that green line? Sorry.
So the green line is,
so
is
the
this
level of slope
that was claimed from other data. Yep. So,
and on the right side, the metal rich.
So metal rich one in our case has a moderate blue tilt.
Are the metals all done by proxy?
Yes, that's it. It's a fit to color. This is true for all of these, right? So the issue whether or not that's accurate, that's uniform across all the different studies.
Steve.
Yeah.
So I imagine what you do to split these two populations is you have a histogram of V minus I and you just cut it right in the middle or something.
No, you absolutely don't do that. So the history is that. So the very first bimodality paper Keith and I wrote in 93, data were really bad. So we had like 50 objects total. So we got quite involved in how to actually determine whether things have two or one populations. And this led us to write a paper on this. This, in retrospect, is a good thing because it gets as many citations as the actual science papers. And so there's these things called mixture models that basically take a distribution and decide if two Gaussians is a better fit than one, or two whatevers you want to put in is a better fit than one, and calculates a probability that any individual object belongs to one or the other. And then the trick is, when you're doing this, is that, well, there's two challenges. One is that this is just, in any individual bin here, it's just one realization of this. So the error, the uncertainty in the peak from just the fit to those data is not actually the true uncertainty, because it doesn't take into account the fact that the uncertainty in where the, for this given small number of finite number of points, where, how it actually divided it up. So we do this bootstrap resampling in each bin and then run it a billion times. And the second thing is, all mixture modeling programs are sensitive to outliers. And so it's turning into details. But so you don't just draw a line down the middle. And the reason it's a problem is because it's not uniform, right? There's more down here than over here, for example. So you're going to get spillover this way, as an example. So you really can't just draw a line. You really don't want to just draw a line down the middle. Although in some sense these are all sort of details. If it's really separated, it's not that unobvious. So that's not the main. It's a minor contributor, exactly how you do the splitting, but it's not the main one.
Is your splitting vertical, or?
Does
this mechanism give you a split?
I think this is also common to most of the work. Each, it's done as a function of magnitude. So if splitting can shift,
split.
Yeah, it has to be, but it's fairly constant in reality. But the point is that you don't know, in fact, I guess if it zigzags a lot, you know that you're having issues with your, it's probably a good thing to actually use as a test, because if it's zigzagging a lot, then your mixture modeling is having trouble separating the populations, which is probably a test that it shouldn't zigzag a lot. And it doesn't in this case. The numbers are pretty good. And we did other things, so you can just fit the brighter parts, you know, where it's better and all this. In our analysis, in our data, it sort of doesn't matter how you split it. You can't look at this and say you see a tilt. It just doesn't show up to the eye. So question then next, and we can come back and I'll answer more questions, is so why did we get it's true that we have 50 orbits compared to one, but still you'd like to understand why is it different. And the biggest difference is here. So you can retroactively say, now what happens is, since we have really deep data, we actually fit for the size of each cluster individually and then determine what's called its aperture correction, the correction to total magnitude on an individual basis. Because these clusters are resolved by Hubble. They're actually pretty well resolved by Hubble. So no matter how you do it, you have you have to make an aperture correction. You have to correct from where you're measuring to some total. And that changes as a function of the size of the object. So we have this exquisite data with high signal all the way down, so we fit the sizes on an individual basis. And so in the shallower data, that's hard to do. And so you either just decide not to, or essentially you might as well decide not to because the signal noise doesn't really allow you to do it very well. So what happens if we just say, okay, let's act like we can't measure the sizes. So we use a uniform aperture correction. Each cluster gets the same aperture correction. We recover most of the tilt. Not all of it, but most of it. And so the biggest difference is that when we compute the sizes and compute an individual cluster size, basically can calculate the cluster size, and then as the bigger clusters have less light within a certain radius in the Hubble image, and nobody integrates out to infinity, so they're all done this way, one way or another, that when we don't correct for a size, we come back, so the biggest get back to something that's more closer to what other people find. So the biggest difference is that when we correct, when we do our, when we compute our sizes, we find a very shallow but not zero mass radius relationship. So the more massive clusters have a little bit different size than the less massive clusters, are a little bit bigger. And given the HST point spread function and give in the two different filters, this causes this effect.
Is it color gradients in most massive clusters?
We haven't looked. We probably should. You'd only see it statistically. So something else to consider. It's, if I'm boring the KITP part of the audience, the T part of the audience, let me know. But the plot without the size corrected, where the objects have a uniform aperture, is actually has less scatter. The peaks are narrower. And so what happens in our way of understanding this is that you basically correct for a bias because there really is a mild mass light or mass radius relationship. But the size measurements, even in 50 orbit data, have some uncertainty in them, and it actually adds some noise even while you're correcting for the bias. So I think arguing that the best one is the one with the narrowest peaks is not the right thing to do in the presence of this potential issue with the mass radius relation. So we'll move on from that. I think I'll say nothing else about data analysis.
Have you heard of the latest stuff from Bill Harris on triangle integrals, six triangle integrals?
I'll talk about it. He doesn't talk about it.
You'll talk about it.
Okay. So,
because I care.
Yeah, that's right. Well, more than that, you mean. So, in general, let's see. I'll say two other things. So, in general, I didn't want to. There's also a completely separate paper Arnav Kundu wrote where he basically goes through and explains in much more detail. He really did it on his own. That's what. How you can get these kinds of things to happen. I also have nothing about ground-based data on here, because if you can pick and choose whichever ground-based data you want, and you get blue tilts and red tilts in either the metal-rich or metal-poor population if you look at the right paper to get whatever answer you want. But I can show that I have the figures if we care. But originally when Fred did this, he said, okay, we want to talk about what each option actually implies theoretically, because we didn't want to have a huge drawn-out discussion about how to do photometry with the Hubble on semi-resolved 25th magnitude objects. So I'll go through this. Okay, so essentially where does everybody end up then? So in the, except for any new papers I haven't seen, the general Harris et al. Conclusion is that it's an effect that's limited to the brightest, most massive clusters. And although this is never written in any of their papers, this is essentially what it means. That since he put, if you actually calculate how many clusters are in, have masses and luminosities as bright as where the Harris et al. Work says there's a blue tilt, it's on the order of 2% or 3%, something like that, depending on exactly. Because the Schechter falloff means there really aren't all that many really massive, really highly luminosity clusters. So
But the trend that you showed at 0.55 was extending down.
Jay may show this too. That's right. So I extended it all the way down to cover our whole data set. In fact, at least in the latest Harris work, although they claim, they, like I said, they never say this directly. They just say it only applies over a certain magnitude limit. So in fact, if you skip down, there's very little difference between our conclusion and the Harris conclusion. Because their statement if you take it straightforwardly, they never write this, where they say it applies, even in the M87, it only applies to the brightest 2 or 3% of the clusters.
Like this, and then it goes...
Well, they don't... Their data, what happens is, since they have these... since they have these distant, mass, big ellipticals, they have no idea in their data set what's happening below about here. Is that about right, Jay?
A little further down, but they haven't... Yeah. I mean, they can't say anything about how far down it goes, really.
Yeah. So they don't. Okay. But like I said, you have to read pretty carefully to figure that out. So that's true. So that's
mass is
10 to the 6. 2 times 10 to the 6.
About that.
I mean, there may be variations between galaxies, there may not be.
Consistent with expectation.
Yeah, but I think it,
just glancing at Bayes and Harris.
Yeah, that's what they say, right? So what they never tell you is what fraction of clusters are actually more massive. I mean, the question are those, so are you explaining the 2% or the 98%, right?
Well, but it's more than 2% of the mass, right?
Depends.
That's what you care about is the amount of mass in the above the clusters, right? There's a lot of 2% of the mass up there.
But that's right, this is by numbers.
Yeah.
It's
certainly not, it doesn't describe typical Glove.
Yeah. Now, this applies only to the Harris distant ones, right? Now, if you look at the Virgo ones, I don't know if Jay has a plot of his. The people who did the work on Virgo find, on average, there's some clusters that have no blue, some galaxies have no blue tilt at all. But on average, that it extends, once again, you can't go as far as these really deep data, but it extends over most of the range that I've shown. So actually, well, that's why we cut it off here, because this is more or less where the shallower data were fit over. But remember, there we go. Remember, over that range, you start to get a reasonable number of Milky Way globular clusters in there, in addition to our M87 ones. So if M87 has a tilt, even if it just stops at where the turnover is, roughly, on this plot that's around here, then that doesn't look like the Milky Way data. That means there should be a tilt through the middle of the Milky Way data. Of course, it doesn't look like our M87 analysis either. But so, for these distant ones, there's really very, you can actually just not worry to some extent. You can say that your typical globular cluster, everything less at 10, roughly 10 to the 6, 2 times 10 to the 6 and less is not self-enriched, does not have a blue tilt in the overall population. And that the brightest few, and as Jay said, if you multiply by mass, the 2% becomes 5 or 10%, there's really not a whole lot of inconsistencies, even though there's lots of disagreement anyway. But the issue is what's going on here. So if I interpreted Jay's paper with Graham Smith correctly, the argument is that where that turnover is varies among galaxies. And the Milky Way happens to have one that doesn't, where it's a pretty high mass, and there are others like M87 in their analysis that are lower. So I'll let Jay give his own spiel. So that's where this is. So in many ways, of course, they don't say anything about what's going on there. But the Milky Way in our analysis, Milky Way and M87 are consistent. There's no blue tilt. And we just don't have enough numbers above 10 to the 6 to answer the question one way or the other, either in the Milky Way or really in these M87 data, if you say it's just at the most massive end.
I know I've asked you before, and there's some new people, and
what's the big deal about this?
Okay, we'll get that. Okay, here we go.
It looks like maybe here. At the high mass end, yeah. There's a bit of self-enrichment. Yeah. It's expected, theoretically, and so there might be a hint of it in the data. And
yeah, so I shouldn't be the, I can add here, this is my answer to that, and then you should give, Jay can give his answer. I think part of what Jay's going to say is why you don't want to just say it's only the top 2%, which is a difference, I think, really, between the way Bill's been writing his papers and the way you have been. But here is my take on it, that you're... For 98% of the clusters by number and 90% by mass, if they don't have a blue tilt, it really emphasizes they're not self-enriched. It's not just the Milky Way, not that we ever expected it was just the Milky Way. And so why does not self-enrichment, and I think you can connect all these things together, which really emphasizes why clusters are not galaxies, how they didn't form with their own little dark matter halo, and they're not self-enriched. And so there's all these things that this is somewhat that really argue clusters had a different formation, different formation mechanism, or just different beasts, and that as you get to the most massive ones, there is this region of a small number of objects for which, you know, are sort of neither. Either one, it's hard to tell which one they are, the whole UCD argument, but it's a small number of things that it's really not that surprising if they are different than galaxies. So, and these things to me are all sort of linked, and they're all linked to how the clusters form as compared to galaxies. If they're not self-enriched, it's not at all surprising then that the ways they're different than a galaxy is they're both not self-enriched and don't have dark matter halos, since the more dark matter halo you start putting around a cluster, the easier it is for it to be self-enriched.
Put numbers behind that?
No, this is designed not to have numbers. So, but okay, you're asking me to put numbers. So self-enrichment, of course, it's a dead set number. In Milky Way, gosh knows what the delta FE over FE is, but it's small, right? And that's the best number there. Now, what that means here, and what I will say, there is one number I can put on it. And this is much for of course, a galaxy, some level goes from -2 to 0, right? So it's a big number. But the other thing is, if we go here, the trend for galaxies, the luminosity or mass versus metallicity trend for galaxies is a slope of 0.3. So at z goes as n to the 0.3, and it actually goes down to 10 to the 6 for dwarf solar masses, stellar masses for dwarf galaxies. So it actually comes down to here with a slope of about 0.3. So it's not as steep as this invisible green line, but much steeper than this. So that's a number you can put in. So what that means for how much dark matter halo you can or can't have requires simulations or at least that haven't been done as far as I know. In fact, realistically, why galaxies have this mass metallicity relation is actually pretty hand wavy at this stage, I think. Does anybody have any different view of that?
The slope is, for dwarf galaxies, is more or less the slope you expect from the classical Dekalb slope picture, right? Or high-mass galaxies, I don't know, it's more complicated.
But the slope is the same, so at some level it's...
What is the, even theoretically this is an area I don't know much about, what are the difficulties in getting, reasonable quantitative estimates from this, like translating some degree of or absence of mass metallicity relation into an upper limit on the mass of the dark matter halo, for example. What are the difficult steps in there?
I just don't know if somebody's done the simulations.
It's mainly a question of what's the distribution of ejection speed of supernova ejecta, for example. That must be very well known.
It's all about where you put the gas, right? So, if you have infall, it'll make it harder.
The supernova clump, then you get super bubbles. It's easier if
they crash together and they radiate the coolant times are very short. So you can't just sort of add up all your energy.
But it's also true if the supernova come together, once one clears out the bubble, then it's easier for the next one to escape. And
that's all kind of uncertain, you know, you throw in.
So even very small detention fractions of supernova ejecta could give you an observable signal. And so you're down into modeling all these more difficult things. Even keeping a very small fraction would already give you an observable signal. I don't have any sense.
Oh, you mean in terms of the fact? Well,
I mean, if I just take a typical supernova ejection speed and compare it to the escape speed from a dark matter halo, that would give me a number. But you're saying that number would be off by orders of magnitude.
Right. Well, that's a huge number, right? That's
like exactly.
That would 30.
Exactly.
Right. So then you have to say, well, that's not the right number. I'm going to entrain some.
Well, certainly if the 10 to the 6 solar mass global cluster can already retain something that might plausibly give you the trend seen at the.
I think the physics is different, right? I mean, in love of the cluster, you've got a supernova going off, right? But all the gas is packed within a couple of parsecs.
Right.
In dwarf galaxies, it's 100 parsecs across.
Right.
How do you mix them?
But if you put the dark matter, hey, I think the issue is if you wanted to self-enrich a fairly compact thing, I think getting it outside moving the gas outside of a parsec or two might not be too hard. The way a dark matter halo would help, and I think implicit in some of these models that people started to write, is that the stuff goes out for a while, but then doesn't actually escape, and it falls back in eventually, right? So especially if you want to peel the dark matter halos to help you, it's unlikely the dark matter is also packed inside two parsecs. And so you probably just have the fact, it like happens in galaxies, it's actually hard to get the gas out of a galaxy. It's not that it doesn't go out of the central parts of the galaxy out of a disk, but it rarely reaches escape speed, or at least it's much.
So I guess for a globular cluster, what you want to know is you just set off one supernova. Some compact region again.
But you actually expect more than one.
Put that thing, which I kind of. Yeah. Now I kind of know what it's going to be. More than one supernova, and I can guess what the gas looks like. I put that in a halo.
But it doesn't happen globally, right? I mean, even if you take a cuspy dark matter halo, it's even at the center where the glove of the cluster is, you only have maybe 10 to the 4 solar masses of dark matter versus 10 to the 6 of the glove of the cluster.
But that doesn't take away from it. Evan's saying, so how far does it go, right?
Oh, sure. I'm just saying, how far does it go? Yeah. Because it's staying down and come back,
I think you need more. The problem is that you expect more than one. At 10 to the 5th and above, you definitely expect more than one supernova per globular, I think.
Oh, yeah, I guess
you're right. So it's one of the reasons it's harder.
Because the first one just spun by in the gas right away.
But even if it starts falling back, then you have another one go off. Now you have a complicated problem, right? Or if you see, you only have one, you have three, but that's three times as much energy, plus they're intersecting each other.
Has anybody done seriously the sort of stuff we're rambling about here?
No, it's a lot harder.
It's not going to fall back on a globular. A globular is tiny. This thing is not living in isolation. It's going to be some share once the stuff gets out of 100 parsecs.
Well, it's not going to fall back on a globular if it's just sitting there by itself. But I don't think what people have done is say, now I'll put it in a dark matter halo. It's a big thing. And I'll increase the mass of that thing, and I'll say when.
But if you had a globular,
it's worried about shear. Yeah.
Universe, it wouldn't quite fall back on it. Yeah. It would be a globular even a dark halo. If the dark halo is orbiting in a larger halo, then it's the gas cools and doesn't slip infinity and fall back into the globular. There's no granular structure that is moving in the dynamic ambient media and with ground pressure and gravitational shear. It's just not going to come back then for the same two parsecs.
You barely need to acquire some tiny bit of angular momentum from an external perturber to not fall back to where the.
It doesn't go back to infinity because it doesn't come back into the two parsecs either. You have to dissipate angular momentum again.
So then maybe that's not a very good argument. Right? Because I could probably put a pretty big halo and then it stays bound to the halo, but I have to bring it back in.
But it'll eventually come back, right? Unless it's truly unbound, even if you give it some angular momentum, it's.
Well, a year later, something else can happen. I mean, how do you flow gas from 100 parsecs to 1 parsec?
It happens, right?
Well, Yeah, very slowly. I mean, if you're dead dwarf galaxy,
don't you have pressure of the gas coming? You don't need gravity.
Well, all you have to do is to.
You have to get rid of the angular momentum again.
All you have to do is to make sure that the globulars is done, and the gas comes back. Well, then we get back to the old problem of why isn't there gas and globulars in the first place? Assuming the gas coming back is the same problem as AGB gas coming out of it.
Except there'd be more of it in this case.
It's dribbling down very, very slowly.
I think that you have to model how far it out it gets, which then affects all these things.
But still, it's an interesting problem, right? And totally different than the dwarf problem, I think. So, yeah, I don't think anyone's done it.
I think it's relevant for this, that we often have this vision of sort of primordial cluster formation, right? But when we see, when you look locally, cluster formation is happening, like I said earlier, at least you think of the antennae or 1275 entities. It's clear it doesn't have anything to do with dark matter or anything else, right? It's just these dense knots of baryons all collapsed together. So one of the issues, and it'll come up later, globular cluster, at least dense, massive star cluster formation mode locally, how similar is that to what the way the more high clusters are formed in an earlier epoch? Because in most ways, you can't tell the difference except for among clusters. Clusters are very similar at low redshift. So if you want something completely different for metal poor high early epoch clusters, it's a little bit puzzling how they ended up so similar to other clusters that probably didn't form at such high redshift in the same way. Let's see. So the question is,
you have not convinced me.
Of what? Which one?
There is something really different here. You know, you say there's different from galaxies. You have not convinced me that I just do all this complicated stuff. And I simply scale down from galaxies in some completely smooth way. Nothing particularly different. I won't get something compatible with it.
But clearly you need, well, if you believe this and not Jay, clearly you need to do something about the mass metallicity relation. You're saying that'll come out naturally. But it turns over. You say it's fine that it turns.
It turns over gradually as whatever complicated physics we've just been speculating about, you know.
Isn't there also an issue that one group is saying in terms of this way, and the other
one saying in terms of this? No, I think one of the issues is that for whatever reason, the mass goes as z goes as m to the 0.3, is seen over the 5 orders of magnitude in luminosity for galaxies. So you're going to extrapolate with a perfectly straight line from 10 to the 11th solar masses to 10 to the 6, but now you're going to turn it over just for the clusters.
At some point, you have to turn over, right? I mean, you've got to hit some minimum metallicity.
Well, but you're not anywhere near that. Oops, wrong way.
But there are two problems. Yeah. One set of data says it's going to 0.3 to 0.5. The other one says it's going to 0.1.
Nobody
has a huge worry.
Sure, that's right.
The other issue is if you put everything in a single plot, you go from 0.3 to 0.29 across 6 orders of magnitude instead of 5 orders of magnitude.
Oh, okay. But I think the first one is, I wouldn't say that we can show it zero, right? It's true that it probably turns, but in fact, the main interest to me is not whether it's really 0.55, it's whether you can prove it's different than the galaxy one at 0.3. And we think we can. And whether it, how much it flattens, I wouldn't be willing to state whether it's.
Those are one deck spread in the list of the reasons on the left.
I think this is the limit. So when we do lots of tests, we basically claim that we're dominated by systematics, not statistical uncertainties, and this is the is symbolic of the systematic effects. And if you tweak things, you could, if you wanted to, in our data set, by tweaking exactly how you choose to fit, by changing some of the details of the mixture modeling, you can tweak this a little bit and get something a little bit bigger than 0.08. We've never been able to get it bigger than about 0.18. So this is in the paper. So we so the statistical, if you take this as the statistical uncertainty, how well we recover what we put in, it's good to a few hundredths. But that's not really probably what dominates it. And basically by doing bazillion different ways to fit this, we'd argue that these things around can cluster around zero to up to sort of the high teens, and we can't really tell the difference. And then it's after that where it becomes obvious, because then the separation just starts to get clear. That's a detail. Back to Fred's point is, it's sort of true, right? So one can imagine by the time one adds all sorts of complicated physics, they can still have dark matter halos, even though the only two we can check in detail don't. And because the dark matter halo physical scale is so different than the size of the cluster, that this won't be affected by that.
You're giving a hard time, but
no, it's okay.
Obviously they're different. They're smaller mass. Yeah. But different in some really fundamental way that hints at a fundamental different formation mechanism. I just don't see that. I mean, that you get a much weaker mass radius relation, of course. I mean, you expect it to weaken at that low mass end, so that's what you're seeing.
And why do you expect it?
Well, they're certainly less massive, but unless you can actually put a number on this.
No. I mean, the relationship between mass and radius is much different from
the cluster. So why do you expect this to change because you went from a galaxy to a cluster?
Well, you see already that trend.
No, once again, I think the other part, maybe I should add the plus and I don't, but both the luminosity metallicity relation and essentially a luminosity size relation in some way or another hold over five orders of magnitude in galaxy luminosity, and then they just don't hold anymore below when you get to globular clusters. And this one, nobody debates. You go from basically something similar to the virial relation of R going m to the point.
You look at global clusters and you see, maybe, or at least their claims, a beginning of this mass metallicity relation at the high mass end.
Yeah.
Do you see the corresponding change?
Yeah, sure, that's where.
At the low mass end of dwarf galaxies.
No.
Not for dwarf galaxies.
No. No.
Not at all.
No.
No, you
no.
See it maybe for nuclei in dwarf galaxies.
Yeah, but you don't see it.
Not for dwarf galaxies.
And it's the same with the mass size relation. And there the differences are starker and nobody argues about it. And there's no disagreement in the literature.
You do see a mass radius relationship with the most massive clusters.
So that's, of course, debated. So when,
Murray has a nice paper explaining why.
Yeah, it would happen. That's right. So Owen Kundu is here. He'll argue it. He can get rid of it easily. But above that 10 to the 6 regime where you start to get is, there are certainly the majority, but not all the literature claims tend to say there's a mass radius relation. They also are often inconsistent with each other, even within that. But that's right. There's certainly, on average, the evidence in the literature is the mass radius relation.
By the way, I thought it said mass metallicity.
Okay, yeah.
Mass radius, of course.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so the question is.
And sigma, I haven't mentioned it, but of course there are also galaxies that don't fall in the M sigma relations.
One or two, right?
So. Well, say one.
Yeah. Well, this is the only. Well, this is a different issue, but this is the only one that, in some sense, is a fair test, in that it's a random cluster.
Yeah, you're extrapolating a lot in the data, inferring the underlying VH given the presence of VH.
Given a press, well, we can. That's a separate talk, right? Or separate discussion. That's right. I agree with that.
That's three levels of jumps there. It's not a direct test.
The question is whether anyone can manage to make a creating black hole system that's shining brightly in X-rays when there's an IMBH sitting in the center of the same cluster. Okay. Well, but do that. We would be happy to see that.
Is that a black hole?
Excuse me?
Is that a black hole?
Yeah. So this is. Oh, geez. Okay. This is an X-ray. This is Macaron. I don't. You probably know Tom Macaron. So this is the object that he found. We found there's like this a globular cluster in this elliptical galaxy that's something 4×10^39 that varied during our XMM observation. So it's well above Eddington for a neutron star. So it has to be a black hole. And since we saw it vary, it has to be a black hole rather than multiple neutron stars.
Yeah, except it's probably a stellar mass black hole.
That's right. I agree. So that's what I said. That's right. So then.
But maybe it has nothing to do with the M sigma relation.
What?
It's just a black hole that was left over.
Okay. The question is, though, can you make? That's right. I agree. So the question is, could you ever have made this binary black hole system if there was an intermediate mass black hole sitting at the center? Because the black holes aren't going to sort of hang around. Of all the mechanisms for making close X-ray binaries in a globular cluster involved interactions in the core.
But you're trying to argue that the presence of stellar mass black hole X-ray binary rules out the presence of a sufficiently massive
edge.
Okay.
See, Stein has at least read the paper. He's nodding. Yes.
Okay. Well, he's nodding.
He's not necessarily agrees. Nodding, that's what it says.
No, yes, that is what you're saying. Yes.
I'm sure I can come up with a way to make a green black hole. I'm going to think of a couple of challenges.
Okay.
Wildly improbable.
That's right. It's not the standard way you're supposed to make them in the course, right?
So this is for next week.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So as we manage to keep going on.
Most people wouldn't argue with.
That's right.
It's there.
Oh, no, it's right. So that's right. So for G1, of course, the question is whether it's in the several times 10 to the 6th transition category, right?
Sure.
So.
G1, is that same M31?
Yeah, that's one.
I'm sure you can still find people would argue with.
That's true, you can.
But is that because that's not a globular cluster?
Well, that's the issue. I said it. That's the issue with that case, whether it is or isn't. As we go on, and there's one. So I was originally planning. So the other, in the spirit of what we don't understand, and also in what I think when I talked to Gene originally, is from the extragalactic case. There's sort of this hubbub about the blue tilt. But for one way or another, actually, it'll disappear sooner than later. The thing that a lot of the work in extragalactic is around in the white paper debate, one of the main things that's said in the white paper is, do we understand this bimodality at all? There's the metal poor ones, the metal rich ones. Why does it divide up in these two populations? So, like I said, it started with really ratty data, and then there was ground-based work, and then there were major HST studies with Kundua, Whitmore, and Larson, and Soren Larson and Gene and others, and then the ACS-VCS one. And this is what it looks like. I thought I'd just show it. These are other galaxies. So the metal poor one and the metal rich one, and the big bright ones are easier because there's a lot more clusters. There are some exceptions. This one's a controversial exception. Not everyone has this. Note if the metal rich population were somewhat younger, it would be a little bit bluer and fill the middle in. So in fact, there's no way a really strongly bimodal line like 4472 can, its metal rich ones just simply can't, it can't have a very much of a, at all of a metal rich younger population because it just wouldn't be nicely bimodal. And you go through, you do a statistical analysis of all these, and here's a good example. And it just doesn't fit any single one zone model, so you need two populations. So I say, do we understand this? The answer is not really. Observers all agree that this is the norm, not everyone, but the norm. And in fact, it was predicted. This is how I started this game. Fred was talking about how HST was transformative. I was hanging around there, but wrote this paper with Keith Ashman way, way back then. Just proves I'm pretty darn old. Forbes, Brody, Grillmeyer, and Cote, Marsky, and West wrote other papers saying how ways this might happen. But the problem is that when anybody bothered to put this into their semi-analytic model, which is how people have to do this because it's not the full-blown in-body simulations aren't up to it yet. Or actually, yes, they sort of are, and they still fail. So there's one paper that nicely shows this. They're actually, I've worked with every semi-analytic group on this, and they all try it, and then they figure out, oh, it doesn't really work when I do the most obvious things, and then they never publish it. So the Beasley one actually published the failure. Well, it's not quite written that way, but it is what it is. And so the problem is that in a simple merger model, you have the metal poor clusters, like the halo clusters of the Milky Way. You merge together the metal and rich gas in the disks, and they form the metal rich population. Everything's all happy. In hierarchical models, the problem is that a lot of this merging keeps going on, but not just with two sort of regular old spiral galaxies. We get too many of these intermediate mass things coming in, and then since all the models have a mass metallicity relation built into their disks, these intermediate mass things bring in intermediate metallicity globular clusters, and there's no bimodality. So bimodality is unexplained, basically. And it's always more fun, in my view, to do this, talk about the unexplained stuff than the explained stuff. Or I just thought I'd emphasize that.
Can you say the same thing about the field stars in the Milky Way?
So the question in the field stars in the Milky Way, I think, actually gets down to the classic G-dwarf problem. So the issue is, can hierarchical models explain the metallicity distributions in the Milky Way? And the halo has a metallicity distribution, and the disk has them, and their disk stars have metallicities. I'm not convinced that any semi-analytic model to actually gets the metallicity distribution of individual stars in the solar neighborhood right. I've only seen one paper I know of. My information could be old, that did this, and it was an old Kaufman et al. Paper, and it claimed it got it right, but it had a steep luminosity function. So the dwarf luminosity function was minus 1.8, which nobody could get away with anymore. You need all these unpopulated halos, right, with a much flatter luminosity function. That is basically buried for star formation has to be really inefficient in the lowest mass halos one way or another just to match the data. And with a steeper mass function, this gives you, in the halo, this gives you more metals to rain down on the disk, to pre-enrich the disk. So when I visited Durham, they had not tested their latest models this way. So that's how it would show up in the Milky Way. The halo metallicity distribution you can get right, I think, by just putting in in two ways. Turning the halo baryons, the baryons in the substructures in the halo into stars can be inefficient. And plus, you can always say that whenever these things do form more metals, you know, they self-enrich a little bit, but a lot of the metals leave and fall into the disk and enrich the disk. So the question is, because for those of you who are young enough, you didn't take a sort of traditional galactic astronomy course. The problem in the Milky Way disk is that if you take a simple closed box around the sun and assume it started at zero metallicity and enriches itself, there aren't enough low metallicity stars. And you can get around this by pre-enriching the disk from halo material, or you can have infall so that a lot of you keep adding new stuff to make new stars at intermediate metallicities. So that's the equivalent problem. Now, there's also some discussion of this in relationship to SEN-A, but there's a real problem with the location of the individual star fields in those cases, because to get the individual red giant counts, you have to be a long way from the center, and there are known color and metallicity gradients in the galaxy. So one of the issues we're talking about TMT science cases, and it was clear in those things that one of the problems with individual resolved metallicity distributions in giant galaxies was actually getting them where most of the stars really are. So that's sort of an aside. Okay, we're gonna.
Your problem didn't work out well. You just kind of count up supernet metals that you'd expect to come from, say, the halo stars, and
If you just do the
observed
observed halo stars, it doesn't work out very well. Partly there's an angular momentum problem that the ones close in go to the center, and there's just not that much out there. So the question, I think, is not whether the galaxy solved the G-dwarf problem. The question is whether the hierarchical models get you the right metallicity. But the same analytic ones give you the right metallicity distribution for the stars in the disk. And that, I don't think, has been tested at that level. They get the mean right, but I don't know if they get the distribution right. And I think that's the equivalent question to whether they get the distribution of the metallicities in the clusters, right?
The floor, which is saying something about what was going on before the disk form, and then...
Yeah, I agree. But the question is whether they get the floor right, right? I think the question is whether you get the floor right. And if there's not, that's what I mean. The question is whether you get it right. After that, it's a mess. The question is whether you get the floor right. Just one thing to say that it was difficult, and then I think I should be quiet, and I guess we're made it to coffee with only one talk. is that one, because nobody can explain bimodality and metallicity, every time somebody says it's not really bimodal and metallicity, somehow the observers are misinterpreting the data, you get lots of attention. So I want to, even though you get lots of attention, I want to go through for a few minutes why this doesn't work. There's this easy way out doesn't work. So in fact, this came out. If I tell you this was a science paper, it would probably cause you to think we don't need to go through all this because it obviously wasn't correct. But. The idea was, okay, it may be bimodal in color, but it's not bimodal in metallicity, because there can be some complicated relationship between color and metallicity. Of course, it's bimodal in metallicity in the Milky Way in M31, but maybe other galaxies are different for some reason. So, I'm sorry, I just really want to sort of drive a stake through this, because it's not... that's right. I don't have the right. So Jay and Jean and Mike Beasley looked at the spectral indices from moderate resolution spectroscopy of clusters in 44782, one of the strongest cases of bimodality in colors, and they found the spectral indices were bimodal as well. And with Aronov and I, we looked at optical to near infrared colors because the basis of this to say that there are blue horizontal branches can mess up your optical colors, but that shouldn't affect the near infrared colors at all. So there's also the fact they never published their stellar populations models, and that there's kinematic differences between the metal rich and metal poor ones. So here it's many fewer objects because you need really deep infrared data to do it right, but the same bimodality you see in the optical shows up in the I minus H, the 0.8 microns minus 1.6 microns. Here is the I minus H versus the B minus I. Here are different models. They go through the data. There's a few outliers, either stochastic effects in the infrared or not true clusters. But the huge majority of the data do this. And here is the gap in the middle. If it was a regular population, things should pile up in the middle, not have a gap. And then actually here is the last thing. It's sort of, here are the metal-rich ones and the metal-poor ones against the radius in M87. So you see that as you go farther out, you get fewer metal-rich ones up here, and more the ratio of metal-rich to metal-poor changes. But the location of the peaks is actually pretty constant. So, but in their model, if the mean metallicity is decreasing, you should get a whole shift. There's no reason that the peaks should stay the same if their peaks aren't real. And so that's another thing. It's also, I kept this up here to show you that what the radial difference between the metal-rich and metal-poor ones is. Here's the metal-poor ones extend much more broadly to outer parts, and here's the metal-rich ones.
Is this still from the famous unpublished M87 analysis?
Yeah, that's right. No, this was published. So this plot was published.
Yes.
That's right. That's right. This is in the 97 paper. I mean, 2007. Okay, here we go. So I'm going to skip all this because, oh, I said I'd show this. So this is what the 4472 looks like. And this is why for doing detailed work in the inner parts, HST is great. For total numbers of these big systems, it has issues. So this is 34 by 34 field. The green ones are candidates identified from a mosaic image. The contamination gets larger out here. Every green one out here is not a cluster. But there's really no doubt the cluster, we actually have radial velocities to show that's the case. The cluster extend over this whole field. And here's where the HST data is, the ACS, and with PIC2. So if you want total numbers, total populations in any way, you really have to combine your nice ACS fields either with mosaic ACS fields or other wide field data. And so I had a whole thing about the total numbers from the blue ones, which is a nice thing that Kathy Rohde's done, but we're going to skip that so we can get our cookies. Oh, well, we get our coffee, so then Jay can go. I'll show these slides later if you want to do the random thoughts at the end, and then we can go. So I haven't said much about ages. It'd be very nice to get ages. They're important, but they're not easy. And so Jay and Jean are experts on high signal noise spectroscopy, and I've worked on near-infrared optical approaches. Understanding the bimodality in some part may depend on understanding how the clusters themselves form, which then depends on conditions when the metal pore clusters form. This connects better back to the parts that I skipped, but I still thought it was worth saying. Because there are all these issues, so are the what are these metal pore clusters like? Did they have dark matter halos? Basically, where and when did they form? And I think without it, these two are not decoupled. Understanding bimodality and understanding how the metal pore clusters form and what conditions they form are strongly coupled. And so we do see cluster formation locally. You maybe even sort of understand it. But there's actually non-trivial parts to extend what we do here to understanding the metal pore clusters. And the main thing is that these things form in regions of high star formation density with high pressures. And actually, you can get sort of a sensible model by just saying, if you take an interstellar, dense interstellar medium, and it's at a much higher pressure because there's the ambient pressure from all the other star formation raises the overall pressure, and that's observed, then whatever clusters form out of this turbulent medium have to be much denser because the pressure is much higher. And when they form stars, they're much denser, their dynamical time scales are shorter. It's much more possible that you can get this high star formation efficiency in this small region to make a bound star cluster, to make a globular cluster. So that all makes sense. The problem is that metal pore clusters are observed over this big region across the galaxy, as the others I wanted to show that. And in a steady state, there's no way you can manage to have a high steady state star formation density pressure, not in a steady state, way out in these outskirts. So you need something else. It may be that it's just not a steady state, that a little dwarf galaxy may just sort of do it all at once. But then it's really hard to model, because it's one thing if you write down equations that are sort of semi-steady state. It's another thing if some compression wave goes through, it is a one-time deal, and then you're done, and it's not, none of it's happening in any, all the time scales are similar, and you can't, and none of it, if all the time scales are similar, your problem is quite difficult. So that hasn't been done, but there's a bazillion other ideas for how you form the metal pore clusters, right? Evan has presented some stuff. And the question is, which one of those is actually right? And I think one of the constraints is that in other ways, the metal pore clusters look just like the metal rich ones, which would be attraction to starting locally and working backward, except for these other challenges. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
Well, you did finish by 3:30.
Yeah, but Jay hasn't.